regard to bridging, making such bridges with secular colleagues. Thinking about that on the spot, and I'm going to share a little bit about how that might be the case. But what I would say, in terms of in your whatever profession you have to be in, the challenge for thinking about how to bridge this, I think, is to start by asking a question, which is this: if you were a secular person, how would you be thinking about bridging this gap? What would you maybe want to ask of someone, assuming you're a secular person who actually wants to engage in a discussion with people of faith? Okay. And so in thinking about that, that might give you some clues about how you might approach it yourself, by trying to think about what's going to be like when I want to talk with this person about that. Now, one of the ways you can start doing this is by listening, because it's kind of nice to know ahead of time when you want to have that kind of sharing with someone where they are already. Mm-hmm. And we're talking about not so much listening to find out about whether someone's like you, which you can listen to find out, and then you'll just have a conversation with someone who's like you. It's about what would people be saying who are not like you? What kinds of things, especially if they're thinking about wanting to know more about what your experience is. So I think you have to sort of develop a certain level of just being perceptive about this. I think the other challenge, which is true in general for Christians when they want to have an exchange about higher things, higher beings with someone, or they want to have an exchange understanding secular people, is that we have been brought up to be evangelists. Part of our charge as Christians is to bring others to Christ. And sometimes when you lead with that, you will chase people away from Christ. So it's really about letting them get to know what it is that's bringing joy to you. Letting them get to know that. Now, in my own, to talk more specifically now, not so in maybe abstract terms, I really, in my years in academia, and I was an academic in a cancer center, I was an academic at a university, I was an academic at an independent research institute, before moving into industry, which has only been 6 years. And when I look back and I think, gee, how did I bridge that? Was I trying to bridge it? When did it happen? And the answer is, not very often. And that really changed about, and I'm going someplace with this, it changed about 15 years ago because of being involved in what some of you have heard about, these roundtables. That's intentional. Someone spending energy and thought to bring people together so that they can have an opportunity to get to know each other around certain topics. We don't have to wait for a program to do that. You can do that yourselves. In your own student universities, wherever you are, you can say, why don't we get together and identify people who are not of faith and just have some lunches together, get to know each other. So I think my final message is going to be, don't wait for it to happen. If you want it to happen, you have to figure out a way to motivate it yourself. So, finishing up with if there are differences between what my experience has been in academia and industry, most of them don't have to do with issues of talking between people of faith and people who are not of faith. Business is really just sort of different in academia because it has more specific drivers for what you're trying to accomplish. And so the people who I meet now, actually they're much easier to interact with in academics. The currency is the same for everybody, and everyone has the motivation in some cases to build out a company that's going to have an impact in the world, it's going to generate some revenue, and in some of us also hopefully generate some good. Right, so I think in some ways, because of that, when you get together with people, it's always for a reason. You learn in business that if somebody's asked to meet with you, they want something from you. And if you don't have anything to give them, usually that'll be the end of that. So in that arena, what I want is for people to discover that there's something else I can offer, which is my life with Christ. And the way that comes about sometimes is because sometimes people come to you for help. Not with their business problem, with their life, or with their family. And I have to say, that's the moment when you say, the way that I can best help you is by sharing with you how I address these things, and that's my life with Christ. So I've found that that's happened a few times in business, because people show up because, you know, I got to sell off my company, or and they're struggling with things, and sometimes it's because, you know, you've invested a lot of your family and now money, and now you don't have it. What are you doing about that? And so in those moments of crisis, that's when I think you can give in a way that may help people to come to what you know. So be creative about it. Look for opportunities. It has to be something that's on your mind to do. And understand that not everybody is going to be accepting of what you have to offer. And also, it's not just one thing. He just sort of, my father, who is an evangelist, he has an approach I've watched over the years. He just sort of keeps coming back to the conversation. So hopefully that's helpful to you. I'll be happy to address questions when we get to that part. Thank you.
Thank you so much, James. Jennifer, if you would go next and describe some of the history that people can be drawing on as they have those conversations.
Yes, and I was thinking about this question of engaging with secular colleagues. I think for me, I'm really struck by that Pew research statistic that you cited. I think 59% of people believe that there is conflict between Christianity and science. And my work has often been with engaging that topic in the context of the church. But I think some of the things that I am saying there could also be brought into a secular conversation as well, into a secular context, because by and large, people do assume the conflict dynamic. They assume a conflict narrative. They assume that Christian theology does not show compatibility with, you know, with what scientific exploration is seeking to do. And so they come with that assumption. And I think that the listening part is really helpful to maybe hear that assumption expressed, because by and large, I think we do hear that assumption expressed in our culture, even just watching a TV show, watching a movie. You know, maybe you're talking about a movie, and then you get into this conversation about science and Christianity. And so even though certainly the relationship between Christianity and science and its history is complex, right? It is complex. I think the onus is on us to draw out those stories that do show affirming, encouraging sort of dynamics in place, because those are the stories that they don't know about. That's the way that you can start to complicate the narrative from their perspective and their mindset. So I love doing that. I do archival research, and I love to find stories that people don't know and to try and bring them to our sense of things as a way to complicate. So a great example would be and you can read some of this that I've published, so you can get more of the details if you like. But I remember when I was working on my dissertation on the clergy of Geneva during the Age of Enlightenment. And I had no expectation that I would be doing anything that had to do with science. Like, when I was doing my research, my focus was not on science, you know, but it could not be escaped. And it was so interesting to read in secondary literature about, the great riots that took place when the different governments sought to introduce a new calendar, tried to revise the Julian calendar. And that is like a story that's passed around from one secondary work to the next, and you kind of track it in historiography, you can track it. And so I was like, that's so interesting. I know that Geneva embraced the Gregorian calendar in anticipation of the new century. And so what happened? How did people feel about it? What did they think about it? And it was like, I'm not seeing any riots. actually, I'm seeing them endow a chair in mathematics. I'm seeing the clergy raise money, funds for a meteorological building. I'm seeing them allowing lightning experiments to take place within the city. It was very controversial in the Enlightenment to allow a lightning rod to be put up in your city. That was a scary, scary thing. But Geneva said, sure, let's include lightning rods because of the belief that electricity could actually heal people, that it could be used in a medicinal way, and it could improve people's lives. And so then I'm like, wait, there are pastors that are filling these positions. There are pastors that are doing this work. And that just really changes our conception, I think, of, you know, the reception of science. In my broader work beyond Geneva, I see how, and I look a lot at clergy, but how clergy function as popularizers of science, actually. When you think about how often, maybe not very often, but hopefully more and more, are pastors using scientific illustrations in their sermons, right? They were doing that in the 18th century. Because of this affirmation that all truth is God's truth, and that the material world is a good thing, and it was created by God. And so all of the good anti-Gnostic tendencies within Orthodox Christian theology can be seen even as in the rise of modernity and in these interesting ways that people often don't know about. And so, so people like John Wesley, the Puritans have such a fascinating relationship with the scientific exploration of their time period. Again, we have to always contextualize, you know, but it might, you know, it surprises people to hear, like, oh, Cotton Mather, who was, you know, became the president of Harvard, but who was involved in the Salem witch trials, also, like, advocated for inoculation to help the populace against smallpox epidemics, and that his house was almost bombed as a result of him writing a piece in the Boston Gazette. And so, you know, that's kind of a fascinating thing too, as we think about vaccination controversies today, and then to kind of bring in this historical story. You know, I think you can engage today's conversation just through drawing from the stories of the past. And one of my wonderful colleagues, Tim Larson, I'm going to plug his work, but he has a few really interesting books. He works on the 19th century, and he also works on science. And I think the 19th century is a really special period because of the rise of, because of Darwin and, you know, sort of some of the shifts that take place. And so his research is extremely valuable for that. And this is a book that he wrote. Instead of Crisis of Faith, it's called Crisis of Doubt. And it is highlighting some really important 19th century thinkers who were sort of seen at their time as secular thinkers, and then they discover Christ. They discover the Lord. And so it's like the opposite story than what you hear, like, oh, the 19th century is all about the decline of faith and the loss of faith. This is like pushing back against that narrative in some interesting ways. He has another book that just came out, this whole series, Spiritual Lives, published by Oxford University Press. This whole series is about pulling out, like, people that you know, that you think you know, and then telling the story of their spiritual lives. And when you explore that, what you realize is that when there are different, right, in every field of research, there are certain questions that are asked and there are certain assumptions that are made, right? And then the next generation comes and they say, no, we shouldn't have assumed that. We need to ask these questions. And it's the same in the field of history as well. Like, we assumed that John Stuart Mill was this way, but we actually didn't research these sources. We didn't look at this data, and we didn't bring these questions. And so when we do, now we have a different picture of the complexity of his life. So that's really quite valuable. And then this is a book that I contributed to recently, Since the Beginning, by Kyle Greenwood. And each chapter, because of course Genesis 1 and 2, right, so important to any conversation for science and Christianity. And what it is really is, in the history of the church, how have these two chapters been interpreted? And so it's going to go from the patristic period all the way to modern theology. And so you'll see, I wrote the chapter on the Reformation, and I talk about Luther and Calvin and how they're engaging, again, with the tradition, the exegetical tradition of interpreting those passages, but then also with the sort of the scientific developments of their own time and trying to think through like how does Genesis relate to what's happening today? And in that way, it's really a model for what we continue to do. Every generation continues to do that. So so those are just some resources, and I'm happy to talk more.
Thank you so much. That was extremely helpful. Dana, we'd love to hear your perspective.
Sure. For a number of years, I worked at Ohio State University Extension in community-based decision-making. And so I think James talked about making those relationships is so powerful in how we relate to one another and sharing our personal stories. And James was a great storyteller this morning that really involved us in his experience. And I think that is where we as Christians can bring some value. Mm-hmm. And so that is something that I'll do briefly here to share a bit of my story, which will set the stage for where I see a bridge between secular and Christianity. I lost my faith as a young science student. Could not get past Genesis. It really was, I was studying paleolimnology at the time, so what I was hearing from those in my church community did not match up with what I could see it. I could study it. It was so much more real to me than this God entity that I had not experienced yet, the Holy Spirit. And so I ended up walking away from Christianity at the same time as walking away from creation science. Fast forward 30 years and had a very strong, profound awakening experience to the Lord. And now I'm a very passionate Christian. And so bridging that gap is something that I internalize and want to do. And so I'll answer the question specific to this panel in two different ways. Not only bridging between the Christianity and the secular, but bridging science with our congregations. I'll share briefly a story of an individual that I knew when I was a non-believer, who was a believer, a very strong believer, even pastored on a part-time basis. And I can remember we had to travel down to Columbus on a regular basis to go to meetings and so forth. And so much of that time was spent talking about. And the one thing that struck me is I never felt judged by him. He knew that I was not a believer. But he shared his faith with me in a very non-judgmental, this is what I believe, and that was very powerful. And I thought about that a number of years later, and I think that might have been why when I ended up opening my mind to really looking at faith again, because I had walked away from it in a very strong way, I think those conversations with him really helped. And so that's one thing that we can do as Christians, is we talk to people who are not of our Christian tradition or have lost faith even, that we are non-judgmental about that. That just because you are not a Christian does not mean that you are an evil atheist, which oftentimes is, and that's something that I taught at a college university for a while. I was always sensitive to the fact that I would have people in my audience that were people of faith. I was not antagonistic to religion. I was very sensitive to that. I didn't subscribe to it, but that was okay. So I think that that's very important. Then the other is bridging that gap between the science that we understand and our congregations that oftentimes do not understand the science. And that is another part of my background that I think is valuable, is I have worked in citizen science for a number of years. And so if we can bring people into doing science, you can understand it better. So, and especially in the Christian community, there is a fear of being part of a scientific process. But if you can do it with respect to, we need to be good stewards of the land. And this is something that I actually presented a couple of years ago at an ASA meeting, was to bring citizen science to our congregations and how to manage that. Can we get congregations do so much great work in service to the Lord? What about doing that in a natural resource setting and becoming a volunteer monitor? and sending that data in and getting feedback. I think that there's a level of distrust for many individuals who are not in science. They just don't trust science. And it's hard to distrust something if you're using it. So getting them to use that. So those are my two tidbits of wisdom, so to speak, and bringing people in and bridging that gap.
That's wonderful. Thank you all so much. I'm just going to quickly glance and see how much question time we have for this panel at the moment. So I believe we should have a little bit. Are there any questions?
Yeah, my question's for Jennifer. So I want to say I think a historian of science position, I think, is such a fascinating job. I think I just recently learned about it, so I'm like involved with it, like with all the books, but. Over the past few years, I've realized how important it is to being a free thinker, to knowing your history,
yes.
and knowing why you believe what you believe,
yeah.
and where it came from. And you know, I've come to that conclusion. I love reading about all the background. But my question for you is, how do you get somebody else interested in that? Because you know the stigma behind history, right? History is boring. We don't want to study history. And what are some practical tips of maybe pulling somebody into thinking about history and thinking about why they actually believe what they do?
Yeah.
And if you could just repeat the question briefly for the tape, too.
Oh, okay. So the question is, why is history not boring? And how do we convince people otherwise? Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, too, because it depends on where you're having this conversation, because you can have that conversation in the church, right? There is a real sense in the church sometimes that, you know, we don't know our history, and that's okay. It's just the Bible and me, and I'm good to go. And so there's kind of, and then there's in the academy, this a real need, certainly, to understand history. I think it's partly it can be a corrective. I think we often don't realize how much our current day perceptions of the world and experiences of the world hinge upon what we think the tradition has given to us, and some of our attitudes. And so it might be in part just like probing someone. I mean, I don't know the exact hypothetical, but probing someone to help them to basically just better understand, like, well, why do you think that way? You know, what is it that has led you to have that attitude? So, I mean, I just think it's exciting, right? I think it's amazing to discover the past and the way that we're linked to the past. Maybe what sometimes hurts history is when it seeks to be irrelevant. the best historians are, some historians do, they want to be irrelevant. That's like their goal. But I really think the best historian tells a story, right? Is telling us a story that is rooted in evidence, right? That is still is interpreted, but is rooted in sound evidence, and that can spark a conversation that is well, I do think there's a benefit to it being helpful today, to being something that is of interest today, to entering into the conversations of today. And to not isolate ourselves. And really, in every academic field, there is the danger of isolating what we do from the broader conversations of not just in the academy, but then in the world, right, in society, in the world. And so the onus is on history, maybe sometimes more than other disciplines, because it's not as clear, but I think it's also on all of us in our fields to engage with today. When I talk to Christians about it, there's obviously a lot more of like the theological or the biblical elements. You know, the Bible talks about our relationship with each other through familial language. We are brothers and sisters in Christ, and God is our Father. That's the way the Bible talks about it. So we're deeply linked to each other according to scripture and theology. So you need to know your family. You actually need to know your family. You need to know where you come from. And there's lots of reasons for that so that you can know yourself more clearly, and so that you can know your relationship with the world and with your context too. So that's one component, one example that I'll often emphasize. The great cloud of witnesses is an important, I think, theological concept as well. The affirmation that Christianity is a faith that believes that God entered into time itself, into the real world, the incarnation and its materiality is hugely important. God in time through Christ, right? And so that's another sort of affirmation of time and knowing our story.
Thank you so much for that deeply thoughtful answer. I think we maybe... Yes, we probably do have to wrap up this particular panel right now, but definitely Dana and James are able to stick around for speed mentoring after the next panel. Jennifer, you're welcome to join us, or not, as you have time. Let's thank this panel for the wonderful job they did. And I'll ask the next panel to come up. Oh, that was wonderful.